How much does this thing cost?
The economics of the future are somewhat different. You see, money doesn't exist in the 24th century.
No money? You mean you don't get paid?
The acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force in our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity.
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, cashing in all of his self-sealing stem bolts.
And this week, what is our conundrum? We are going to talk about things that don't make sense in Star Trek.
Oh, self-sealing stem bolts, they make tons of sense to me, Cam.
Yes, because one of the wonderful things about really any fictional world, whether it be, you know, Harry Potter, Star Wars, or Star Trek, there's a lot of elements within the world building that maybe don't quite make a lot of sense. They aren't thoroughly thought through because, again, it's an imagined world versus a realistic world. That's why we want to live there, because it's not like our world.
Yeah, like how come the Gryffindors didn't stop Hitler? Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Oh, believe me, those prequels really open a lot of doors for the Fantastic Beasts movies.
You're really into Grindelwald at this point.
God, those movies are terrible.
They really were. I only watched the first one. It was so bad, I couldn't bother with the second one because those reviews are pretty bad as well. So I'm totally done with that franchise at this point anyways.
The second one was worse.
Was it? I can't do it. I'm just not going to watch it. Okay.
Quite a bit worse. So.
Well, we like the Harry Potter movies. It's just the Fantastic Beast ones that really stink.
I don't want to find them.
No. Okay. So Cam.
Yes.
On our topic now, look, there's just so many weird, strange idiosyncrasies within this world that they've established, this universe that they've established that is Star Trek, that make us scratch our heads. But I think they kind of do these one-off lines and we're supposed to just go with it, which I'm usually somebody who just likes to go with the flow, you know, like,
well, I think we do go with it too. Like, I think when we're actually watching the episode, we go with it. It's just when you do an overview of the world, it's like, wait a second.
Yeah. So we can address this from a practical perspective. I think you and I are mostly focused in our critiques and critical analysis. It's mostly focused on like storytelling and character stuff. We don't get into the too much of the nitpicky stuff. So this is really meant to be more kind of fun and kind of critically analyze like this universe, which we absolutely adore here. So we're not going to be too harsh on any of the series.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cam, you kick it off. What doesn't make sense in Star Trek to you?
Okay. Well, I think I want to bring up entertainment. I don't really understand the future of entertainment in the Star Trek universe.
It's all about jazz.
Well, exactly. It's all about jazz. It's about watching like Shakespearean companies put on plays in like, you know, like basically the auditorium or whatever it's called, where the crew all assembles, usually in a cargo bay, actually, that's been converted to like a theater.
Don't forget Neelix's mess hall.
Well, yeah, Neelix's mess hall as well. And TV is obviously not a thing anymore. Movies, it seems, only exist in terms of old movies, as we saw on Enterprise. There seems to be no forward momentum on any of these things. Yes, we have the holodecks, and we have, for example, holonovels like Tom Paris writes. I can understand, you know, we have VR here. Like, that makes sense to me that there would be an evolution of that. But it seems like there's only one, like, artistic art form moving forward. And I don't even know that I would call it that artistic because it doesn't seem to be that much about expression.
Yeah, and look, they've hinted at it, but, like, that holodeck, it is used for other things, you know, than just reenacting Shakespeare or Captain Proton adventures, right?
What percentage do you think it is used for those reasons? I'm going to say a very high percentage, like maybe I mean, excluding things like setting it up to, I don't know, like you see some episodes, they test it for like, or they use it to test like equipment or theories or something. I'm going to exclude those sort of workplace uses. In terms of recreation, I'm going to say like, it's got to be like, what do you think, 65%?
I'd say it's Quarks, about 75. And then on the Enterprise D, I was thinking about like 45.
That actually does make sense. Yeah, probably less, especially on like Picard's ship. That definitely seems to be the case. Yeah.
He puts his foot down.
That's right. Yeah. He's observing them all. He's like, he's standing outside the door every time someone leaves the room and he just gives them a disapproving glare.
Well, one of my favorite lines in all of Star Trek was from The Perfect Mate, where we have Riker say goodbye to Famke Janssen, and then he hits his comm badge and says, if anyone needs me, I'll be on Holodeck 3. Just like, okay.
Well, I do appreciate he feels the freedom to just announce this to everyone, I suppose.
Well, there you go. Okay. Well, the other thing this leads to, though, is the absolute obsession with the 20th century that these people have when it comes to their entertainment. This would be like you and I doing nothing but LARPing and pretending we're going to Renaissance fairs like every single weekend, right?
Yeah, it does. And I mean, I was someone who did study medieval lit in university for multiple semesters. And I can tell you to this day, like, I don't read exclusively medieval lit.
Right.
Like, there are other things out there that are great. And it just leads me to the then question, like, did World War III perhaps end those visual arts? Like, is that what happened? And, like, music? Like, I just don't even understand what happened to these industries or even the need just for artists to express themselves in this way, in a way that would get mass, you know, attention.
I'm curious, though. You claim you don't exclusively read medieval lit, but
right.
If we're talking about Canterbury Tales, you're always reenacting the squire's tale.
Sure.
You're always making me listen to the monk's tale as you recite it. So maybe I take a little bit of issue. You're really into the parson's tale too, I think.
The Miller's tale, man. That's the amusing one.
I'm more of a Reeves tale kind of guy. That's sure. Just me. So.
But does it not like seem strange to you that just like all these arts just died except for Picard and crew just obsessing over very specific ones too? It's not even like they have this wide diversity of, you know, artists that they're bringing up.
Like in the vacuum of the universe, it doesn't make sense. But like, of course, we know as viewers, it's really just kind of shorthand for audiences so people can relate and understand kind of what's going on. For sure. I totally get that aspect. But I agree with you. What you're saying, it just does not compute because it's a very narrow field of what people are interested in, whether it's jazz music or like Shakespeare. That's pretty much all it is, right?
Yeah. I mean, the movie nights on Enterprise were, I mean, I guess refreshingly diverse in terms of the types of movies they were choosing, where you would get like universal horror mixed with, you know, some romantic comedies and things like that. Like it wasn't just one specific thing or one director. But I wonder what the reasons for this are. Part of me thinks it's because when you try to create like futuristic music, it often sounds really dorky within like 2 years.
It's all like techno synth sort of stuff.
It all sounds like that music from the end of Revenge of the Nerds. Yeah. But, you know, like you did see, I'm trying to think of examples of futuristic music. There is like the four-armed like keyboard player we saw in, which two-parter was that?
Oh, that was in...
Unification, right?
I don't think so. Was it not Gambit?
It's Gambit or Unification, one of the other.
I remember they had to engage with like that Ferengi. I think Crusher was there. Worf was there.
Right.
I think Troy was there and Riker was there. I think, fans, write in. We'll soon figure it out, but yeah.
But I mean, it just, that's one of the few examples I can really think of. But I look at like when Star Wars did like the Cantina March, or the cantina music, I'm like, that works. You know, I don't go like, oh, that's so 1977. I guess that's a difference though with John Williams versus like, you know, no offense to any of the composers working on Star Trek TV shows, but they got to crank out those scores real fast.
Yeah. So I also think about the fact that when it comes to Star Trek, Cam, if we're jumping from bar situation, let's go to another bar situation. Talk about the economy of the Star Trek universe.
This may be an extended conversation here.
Well, I'll read you a quote. This comes from Star Trek First Contact. This is one Jean-Luc speaking to, of course, as we know it, Alfre Woodard playing the great Lily Sloan. He says, "The acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force of our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity." Okay, that sounds amazing. But how does it work, though? Like, truly, like, what we see depicted, though, in, say, Deep Space Nine is a bartering system that is very, very difficult to navigate. You've got episodes like In the Cards, Treachery, Faith, and the Great River. It seems like an absolute headache for anybody to acquire, not necessarily wealth, but anything that would be of even sentimental value. Does this make any sense to you?
Not really. Or even like in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan, where Bones gets Kirk like the old glasses. Like, if you live on Earth and you have no economy whatsoever, and you are like, you know, I'm sure the Mona Lisa is on lockdown, but there's some antiques or something that are of great value from probably the 20th century, because that's what matters most in Star Trek. Like, is it just free? Or how does this work? Do you have to come up with something of equal value? I've never really understood that, because, you know, obviously replicators, and I'm sure we'll get to those later, but replicators can replicate so many things, but it seems like people are, as you said, they're after baseball cards, they're after antique eyeglasses. Like, what are they trading for an antique?
Like, they want authenticity. And before I lose my train of thought, I do want to confirm that the four-armed keyboard player was in Unification. That's the two-armed.
Okay, there we go. Everyone can sleep well tonight.
So the replicator essentially reduces the value of everything, right? So that actually then puts a premium on authentic items, like we're talking about, you know, like trading cards, for example. I also wonder what it does for fresh groceries and spices that we know that Ben Sisko likes to acquire. Well, wouldn't everybody like to have fresh groceries? If so, then that increases demand. But is there not limited supply if there's not an incentive for people to grow these sorts of things, right? So then you have supply meet demand. So then how do you distribute that? Like, it seems incredibly complicated. And would not an admiral be able to acquire, say, fresh groceries more easily than a cadet at Starfleet? So then you have inequality going on throughout the Federation. But as we are told again and again, the Federation is all about equality. So this is why a lot of it just doesn't make, you know, just logical sense to me.
And what is to stop you from, say you do want to purchase something valuable or acquire something valuable, can you just replicate something valuable and trade for that? Like, is someone going to know?
I think people could authenticate it. Like, well, give me an example of that, though. I bet I could come back at you. Because I'm thinking about an episode that I watched very recently, which is Who Mourns for Mourn?
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, like, Quark dives into this vault to start clicking together bricks of gold-pressed latinum, but there's no latinum inside. And all he finds is worthless gold, and they all just crumble in his hand. So I wonder if gold is easy to replicate, but what gives latinum its value is that you, say, cannot replicate latinum.
Right.
That would make sense to me.
Right. And I mean, I guess carbon dating, you could easily determine the age of something. So I guess...
Yes, Cam. 36 months old. 36 months old.
No, it was 37.
36 months old.
Oh, 37,
my apologies. My apologies.
But yeah, I mean, I guess ultimately, you couldn't, you know, replicate a Fabergé egg because they would obviously know immediately that it's not authentic. So I guess maybe they have somehow tied off that loose end, and that I don't know that there is anything of value if anyone can confirm that it was recently replicated. But then, this also then begs the question, is everyone living in absolute, like, paranoia that everything they're being traded is a replica?
Well, exactly. And so, it just seemed kind of unfathomable that this would go out with any hitches, which is why we see an episode like In the Cards, you know, where they're trying to trade up for things, or Treachery, Faith, and Great River, where, you know, we need to get a guy's, or we need to get Cisco's desk to some other guy so he can take a photo behind it, you know, like to trade up for favors.
Mm-hmm.
It's just bizarre. But even think about an episode like Encounter at Farpoint. We have Beverly Crusher making reference to charging this fabric to her credits. Like, she's like, yeah, I've got credits. Okay, well, what are these credits? They never expand on that. And then in Star Trek Picard, we've got like Raffi living in a trailer park while Picard is living on a chateau. But Rios, he actually makes a number of references to how much cash they'll need to afford his services. So I'm like, okay, like maybe he operates outside of the Federation. I can understand that. But then how does Picard have access to this cash that Rios needs, you know? And what? Picard's producing all this wine. That's of value.
Yeah.
But I don't know. Do you not have some communist socialist government acquiring the wine and distributing it? Or is it up to Picard who he distributes to and for what cost to cover the price of like labor and manufacturing distribution? Like, it's just kind of like they just leave it so vague that it makes me like step back a couple paces.
I mean, I'm sure those Romulan helpers are wondering why they signed on for this.
They still haven't been paid.
Yeah, they're stomping grapes all day. And it's like, Well, you've served your community. It's like, wait, what?
Well, one of my favorite references, though, to this bartering system comes from Star Trek The Voyage Home, where they try to pawn off Kirk's eyeglasses.
Yeah.
And I think the guy, the pawn shop broker, offers him like $200. And Kirk's like, is that a lot? having no sense of money whatsoever is just kind of, it is funny.
I feel like William Shatner lives like that now.
How much is a banana? $10?
But we have seen in episodes of Star Trek, they have like replicated coins to take down to planets to use. So it's like, what's to stop them from just replicating all these currencies? You know, Rios wants money. Well, can't you just replicate tons of money? Or on Voyager, when obviously they're in real issues in the Delta Quadrant, why not just replicate all of the currencies you could ever need and just pay everyone whatever you need to get home?
Well, I mean, like, my initial argument would be like, well, they're probably using something like Bitcoin. Like, that all has to be digitally authenticated. But then the thing is, look, I already brought up, we've got, like, you know, Gold Press Latinum. So it's obviously that there is kind of this currency. That's why I was suggesting that currency as we know it, the value there, though, is derived from the fact that it cannot be replicated. That's what my argument would be in those cases. The other thing I have to think about, though, it's very clear that, you know, Jadzia plays Dabo.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to have acquired those, you know, strips and slips of Gold Press Latinum somehow. I don't know how, but you know, she's gambling. And what did the players in the poker tournaments on the Enterprise D, what are they playing for exactly? Like chips, like plastic chips?
Do you think it's kind of like Pogs, where you just keep playing and you'll win each other's Pogs, but then you're going to win them back and it just goes back and forth, you know, ad nauseum until Pogs become outdated and no one knows what they are?
Could you imagine Worf busting out like every, like the first round, and then he just walks over to the replicator and replicates more chips and then brings it in. Like, screw you, bro.
I mean, I can totally buy that those poker games on Next Generation are just purely for fun.
Yes, yes.
I don't think that's as big a deal in terms of the winnings. But no, on Deep Space Nine, that like Dabo games and everything, oh, 100%. And you're right. Like, you know, the aliens going through, I imagine the currency means something to them. But yeah, what does it mean to Jadzia, or what does it mean to Bashir if they win? Like, are they like, hooray, money to spend on nothing because I don't spend money?
My best guess is that there's some sort of universal basic income in Star Trek. So if you pursue other avenues, you know, we knew that Bashir's father had like a new job every 6 months, you know, whether he was like a landscape architect or what have you. maybe some things offer a little bit more than others, but either way, you're going to be taken care of by the Federation system.
I suppose so, unless you're Raffi.
That was just weird. And then their explanation is like, well, she's an addict. I'm like, you don't have treatments for like addiction in the 24th century?
It's a real bummer that apparently the way to beat addiction is you just have to go cold turkey for a couple of days.
That was so bizarre.
Yeah. It's like, really? This is the best treatment we've got in the 24th century? Almost the 25th?
Mind you, she seemed perfectly okay after 24 hours of cold turkey.
Maybe we shouldn't be questioning it.
Yeah.
Maybe there's a hypo spray or something that she was taking that we just didn't see on screen.
I guess that makes the most sense. So, Cam, what's next on your list? What doesn't make sense to you in Star Trek?
Well, I want to dovetail off of the economy one, and let's talk about jobs. Because we see that, obviously, a lot of things still run. Like, Joseph Sisko runs a restaurant. How many of these like restaurants and all these sorts of industries would be even running? Because
Sisko is clearly running it for the love of it. And I assume that he's a great cook, but what about these restaurants? It's just like crappy cooks. They don't care if they get customers. Are they just filing their nails all day long?
Well, exactly. And I mean, I can totally believe Joseph Sisko, as we saw, a bit of an eccentric old guy. I totally believe this guy's happily running his restaurant. But I mean, what does he do when it's like swamped? How does he get staff? Like, I would imagine it would require quite a few people to run a restaurant. Yes, we see that Jake and Ben will help out, but they're not there all the time.
And
that's just one restaurant.
And if I'm being honest, if you are living in the 24th century and you have the opportunity to travel the stars, are you working as a server at a restaurant?
No.
So.
And what's to stop you from being like, I don't feel like going in today.
Exactly. So my guess is, and this is what we're seeing more, if you go to countries like, say, Japan, when it comes to service staff, they have like just kind of a shallow pool. Like people don't want to take those jobs. So you'll see a lot more automation in Japan. Last time I was there, I was ordering off of iPads. And so you wouldn't need a server to come at you. But the problem is you have people like on Deep Space Nine, such as Broik, who is very clearly, you know, like a waiter. So they do have waiting staffs. It's not all just about automation at that point. But
yeah,
I don't know. It's kind of a weird thing, you know, especially when – doesn't it seem like a very classist system in the Star Trek universe where the people at in Starfleet are all the superheroes of society?
Yep.
And then after that, is everyone else just chumps?
I mean, I guess so. It seems like it, because I can't figure out, obviously a lot of jobs, as you referred to it, automation there. I would imagine a lot of jobs have been filtered out, maybe the less desirable jobs, just because no one would want to do them for essentially free. But I would imagine the population would probably be bigger at that point, or at least pretty equal. And it would seem like there would be a lot of people, you know, just kind of kicking around, because Starfleet's not going to take everyone. It seems to only take, in theory, the brightest and the boldest, Captain Harriman. But that would seem like there would be a lot of people left just at home. And I know that, like, there's a line also in the neutral zone where Picard talks about, you know, service to one species is the ultimate goal. And it's like, well, that's all well and good, but are you telling me that just your average person who didn't go to Starfleet is doing a 9-to-5 job just because they want to or feel they have to? I feel like the future of WALL-E is more believable than the future of Star Trek, where apparently people just really just want to go to work for just for free.
Well, I agree. Kind of the economic theory right now, though, is that as more jobs become automated, you know, there's the great fear that it'll just create larger gaps within society, which I think is a very real fear. But the other theory, though, is that as more jobs are freed up through automation, that will give people more time to pursue their own passions. So maybe that's what people in Starfleet are really doing, though. They're pursuing their own passions. The rest of society, maybe they study art. They look into, you know, genetics, you know, not because they have to, but because they truly want to. Because if all of those necessary jobs, like say plumbing or garbage duty, if that's already fulfilled through automation, then you can just pursue whatever you want. Like, Cam, would you not love to just, I don't know, watch movies and review them all day long? That's your passion right there.
I would, but, and this is a conversation that's actually very timely because I've been having it with coworkers at work during the COVID crisis.
Sorry, where are these coworkers?
Oh, I work in a bakery, so.
No. But you said coworkers at work.
Oh, well, fair enough, yeah.
Sorry. That's just me being a jerk.
But, you know, do you think you would actually accomplish a lot if you had nothing but free time? I find a lot of people, the answer is no, including myself.
I like to be somebody who is kept busy.
Yeah.
So during this pandemic, my job, I know your job has been exceptionally busy. Mine has been as well. That's kept me like sane at this point. I could not imagine, like I've got many friends who've been laid off amidst this. They are bored out of their minds at this point.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, oh, exactly. Yeah, same here. And I just look, even take like a, you know, 1 or 2 week staycation and tell me how much you're accomplishing by the end of that.
Well, maybe that's why we can go back to that quote from Picard. You know, the acquisition of wealth is no longer the driving force of our lives. We work to better ourselves and the rest of humanity. Maybe that's just all it is. It's simple as that.
I guess so. I think we just have to take this one on faith.
Yes.
Literally all of humanity and all these aliens we encounter are just like, nope, that's what we do. We have a complete shift in psychology somewhere along the line, I guess after the World War III.
Yeah. Well, so jumping off jobs and the economy, why don't we tackle politics here? Because it's always been very vague how the Federation functions. And I think that's actually smart, because if you get into the nitty-gritty of it, would any of it really make sense? I originally thought of the Federation as being more like a federal system, like how Canada and the US have provinces and states. But I think the more we dive into it, that it's just clearly not the case, because of course we've got, you know, the Vulcan ambassador to Earth, for example.
Yeah.
But it's also not like the UN, though. I think it's more closely aligned, you know, the Federation, you know, the different planets, they're far more closely aligned to each other than the UN is, despite, you know, the illusions with like the Federation flag versus the UN flag. My theory, and I don't think it's totally out there, is that the best comparison right now is really the Federation is most likely, you know, akin to the European Union, where you have independent states, but they're very, very intricately linked through free trade, common security, aka Starfleet, no borders or immigration restrictions, maybe a common economy or currency, if we could ever figure out how the currency works. I think the Federation is more like the EU than the US. Does that make sense to you? Does that track with you?
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I would be curious, because obviously when Gene Roddenberry's creating Star Trek, in many ways, like, the Federation is the stand-in for the USA. I wonder if there was a shift in the minds of the writers as they got into the Berman era and beyond. I'd be very curious to know if they did change that kind of mindset.
Well, there's also a weird thing going on here. I'm utterly baffled by the makeup of the Federation Council the few times that we've seen it depicted.
The Russian nesting doll?
Well, not necessarily like what they look like, but maybe what they're wearing. Like, go to The Voyage Home, where you see, like, I think what, like a third, maybe even close to half of the council, they're wearing Starfleet uniforms.
Yeah.
Could you imagine if, you know, look, Starfleet, they're a paramilitary organization. They're responsible for both defense and exploration, but it makes them a paramilitary organization. Could you imagine if we had members of parliament that were by law, like, designated to sit in parliament, and they would be having a say on civilian policy? That's an authoritarian state right there. That's what we see in, like, North Korea. I find that to be probably even the most egregious thing, in that, like, Starfleet representatives seem to sit in the Federation Council.
Yeah. No, it's very accurate. And we've seen as well, like, Admiral Layton was, like, basically interfering with, like, the president.
He was getting martial law declared by a very inept equestrian-esque sort of president. Who is the best president? That guy from Paradise Lost or Kurtwood Smith from Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country?
I mean, hands down, Kurtwood Smith in Undiscovered Country. He was badass.
Is that why you wear the same glasses as him?
And I'm trying to grow the same facial hair, yeah.
It's going good in the quarantine because you have every excuse not to get it chopped off at this
point. Well, exactly. But yeah, like I've never really understood like the presidency either because, I mean, look at like the conflicts over just like, you know, whether it's like a Canadian prime minister or a U.S. president. Now imagine the entire like federation voting on one person and they somehow wound up with that horse dude from that DS9 two-parter. Like to me, it's very confusing.
Well, let's think about it. Like they've established that Earth has 9 billion humans living on it. What if you're a member of the federation and your planet only has, you know, 100 million humanoids on it?
Yeah.
Like what kind of representation do you get? What if they wanted to, I don't know, take over one of your moons or something? Like it's like these kind of weird sorts of things that does everyone get veto power? I think not, because then what would be accomplished? So that's why I like the idea that it's mostly like a large group of semi-autonomous planetary states that get to have sway on the broader political matters guiding the values of the Federation versus day-to-day policy on every individual planet. That's my rationalization in my own head.
Why do you think we've never gotten like the inspirational Federation president character?
Oh, I think it's the same reason we've never really gotten the inspirational admiral character. Although there's some exceptions, you know, like we liked Katrina from Star Trek Discovery, for instance. But I think it's because you always want to make it clear that your Starfleet protagonist has all the answers, and authority figures above them are either doofuses or rotten apples.
I mean, that's it's a real iffy thing where, as you said, like the head of the paramilitary like ship is knowing more than the president of the entire Federation.
Yeah,
that's not great. That's not a great look.
it's very authoritarian, though.
Yeah,
it really is. You know, and like there's other stuff maybe we can get into later on that like I'm just like yeah. There is a bit of an authoritarian bent towards the Star Trek universe.
Archer became Federation president, didn't he?
Yeah, and that disturbs me, though, because it's, you know, I guess the biggest analog would be Dwight Eisenhower, you know, going from Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces into becoming President of the United States. But I don't know if military has the insights into civilian life to make them good leaders for civilians, though. These are very, very different cultures. And I'm not saying anything to disparage the military at all. Mm-hmm. It's just they're different values, different cultures exuded within civilian versus military life. And so to get a paramilitary leader to lead civilian life is just kind of like, okay. Although, at that time, the Federation is, 5 or 6 planets? So maybe they just needed more of a figurehead at that point.
It would be amazing if Keith Carradine's character was running against Archer for Federation president.
They'll make him, deputy president or whatever.
Maybe he was his running mate. There must be a vice president, right?
I'd assume so.
Yeah. I wonder why we've never gotten a vice president to popped up.
We've only gotten 2 presidents. If we're getting to the vice presidents, you're really down the ladder at that point.
I wonder who Archer's running mate was, though. I would be very fascinated to know who Archer chose.
If it was a character that we've encountered before, I don't want it to make his running mate to be like Captain Hernandez. You know, I want it to be like kind of a civilian character. It's unfortunate, Saval. Saval's still alive.
Yep.
By the end of the series.
Yep.
Do you think his running mate could have been Saval?
Yeah, I don't see why not. Saval, I think, would be pretty good. I wouldn't have said that at the start of the series, but I think by the time you get to season four, Saval, I think he could fit the bill for sure.
What if Shran gave up his diamond smuggling side business? Do you think Shran could be vice president?
I mean, if he was, I curse that we never got that TV show.
I know.
The Archer Shran, like, leading the Federation show. I think that would be amazing. I just want to see, like, Shran being forced into giving speeches he doesn't want to give.
Okay. What would we call that show? Star Trek West Antenna?
Deep Space West Wing?
Deep Space... Okay. Deep Space West.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a clever title off the top of my head.
Okay. We'll brainstorm some stuff for later.
Yeah.
Cam, what's next on your list? What doesn't make sense to you in the Star Trek universe?
I don't know that it doesn't make sense. It's more of a curiosity. But
okay.
What is the future of academic institutions? Because we see that Starfleet Academy seems to be the be-all, end-all. You know, you go there, you got a career in Starfleet.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know. What's Yale doing those days? What's Harvard doing?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, was not Data depicted as being a professor at Oxford in All Good Things?
He was, yeah.
So they're still kicking around. So, look, there's always room for the liberal arts, you know?
Sure.
I don't necessarily think the Federation, or sorry, I should say Starfleet Academy is where you want to go if you're studying history or philosophy or literature.
That's true. But... we have a reason, I guess, to go to get these degrees, and that in theory they lead to employment. Aha, if you got a liberal arts like me. But would as many people be racing to do these universities? And universities are a business too. I mean, I guess they're just operating for free now.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, we already see that in a couple countries in the developed world. So,
yeah.
But you have to be accepted. Remember when Jake got that fellowship in New Zealand to write?
Yep.
He had to be accepted, and he was able to defer it for a year. So that was interesting. So there definitely is kind of the academia that we know of. It's just, I think the nature of it has shifted where, as you say, the be-all, end-all is being accepted in Starfleet Academy. But jumping off that, Cam, does every single Starfleet cadet, must they all attend the academy in San Francisco? Are there no, like, campuses on other planets, or does everyone from the far reaches of the Federation have to travel? I don't know, like, couldn't it take, like, I don't know, a year and a half to get from, like, the borders of the Federation all the way to San Francisco?
Well, I mean, do you think the space in San Francisco is big enough to house all the students that would be coming for Starfleet Academy?
Well, didn't they say in Discovery that there are, I think, like, 10,000 ships in the fleet?
Yeah.
So what, multiply just the ships, let's say there's an average of what, like 300 people per vessel?
Yeah.
So I've probably lost, but you're talking about 30 million Starfleet officers just on ships. Like, let's double that for support staff. So you need 60 million people in active duty.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think one single academy that, as we've seen depicted on screen many a time, could handle that sort of churn.
Well, much less when you consider, for example, when Wesley had to go and write that test and only one person got in.
Yes, he was beaten by the Benzite. The boy genius beaten by Benzite.
Yeah. And so it seemed like that one person from that group of eight, like, to me, in my mind, the amount of people you'd need... you would be testing groups far bigger than eight.
Maybe that's why they let Nog in.
That's probably true. Maybe they were accepting more at that point, because otherwise this whole system of eight people going in to get tested is, I would hate to be the instructor that has to do these tests on eight people at a time, like over and over and over and over.
Maybe that's why they get very cruel by the end of it, like doing all these like very sociopathic psych tests on people, as we saw depicted in that episode.
Like the fire test wasn't even part of the curriculum. The teacher just
snapped a twig and
lost it and was like, I want to see what happens.
Well, the other thing to consider, though, if we're talking about like kind of like post-secondary education, is Vulcan Science Academy. That's been referenced as well.
Yep.
But is it not kind of a racist organization? Like, are their standards just so high that literally no other species is qualified to be accepted? You know, like, that, as far as we know, Spock rejected his acceptance and Burnham could have been accepted, except Sarek deferred her acceptance towards Spock. So yeah. I don't think any other species other than Vulcans have been accepted. That seems a little bit xenophobic or racist to me, right?
Not only that, Burnham had a pretty easy in with Sarek as her, you know, adopted father.
And even then she couldn't get in.
True. But if you're going to get in, having Sarek there is one thing. Anyone else is screwed.
Yeah.
Like, no one else is getting in. Unless you're Sarek's kid, you know, good luck.
Do you think Wesley could have had a shot, even if he couldn't get into Starfleet Academy his first go-round?
I would doubt it. I mean, all of sort of that element of world-building with the Vulcans doesn't really exist when you get to the, like, the Berman era stuff. Like, kind of just, well, yeah, you do obviously get bits of it in Enterprise, but more in like the 24th century shows. They yeah. kind of shuttle the Vulcans off screen for the most part, with, you know, aside from the odd guest appearance. But I mean, I would love to know if, I mean, because I'm trying to think, did they say that Burnham would be the first human admitted if she were to get in?
Yes.
Yeah. So that doesn't obviously show any sort of, you know, past of inviting them in. So I don't think that
maybe
many
it's
humans
just filled.
Been.
It's filled with Tellarites. I would watch the hell out of that Vulcan Science Academy TV spinoff. Like, if it's just Tellarites and Vulcans going at it.
Well, I mean, I would have to imagine then, do you think there's like an Andorian exploratory school or a Tellarite one, or like, do all the species have their own schools?
Because we do know that there's the Vulcan Expeditionary Group.
Yep.
So that tells me that, you know, look, Starfleet is kind of like the top tier sort of thing that you want to go into. But look, even if you don't join, I don't know, the Navy, you can still row boats, you know. So true. There's like other organizations you can get involved with. So that, yeah, I would say that the Tellarites have their own expeditionary group, just as the Vulcans do. I would say other species have that ability. And look, if Star Trek tells us anything, like, there is a big, big whack of work for, say, cargo crews and freighters and the whatnot. So you could always work on those.
Space boomers,
yes. Good Mayweather reference right there, sir.
Yeah. Have they ever talked about Klingon training to go into the, like, out to the stars?
I think... I'm trying to think about... Remember that episode, Sons and Daughters, where we have all those new recruits show up on the yeah. Rotaran? That was the first and only time I can recall that we see kind of, like, newbies show up on a ship. Mm-hmm. I'd have to believe that they get some sort of, like, you know, at least basic training, you know, like, make them go through an obstacle course, right?
I would have to imagine. To me, there was always a bit of a disconnect, though, between, like, obviously Klingons are training in, like, war a lot, like, at least the warrior class. Like, they really are training for combat a lot, and they're very good warriors. But I could never quite connect that to, okay, here's how you use the computer, here's how you start the, you know, the warp speed and whatever. Like, yeah. I could never quite go from them, you know, training with batliths to them, like, doing heavy computations in ships.
Do you know what I think it is, though? Just like the Federation, the Klingons must rely heavily on automation. And so it's just minimal amount of work needed to be done on those buttons on the bridge.
It's just one single button.
Yeah.
Or it's the equivalent of Riker with the joystick in Insurrection.
You mean the manual steering column?
It was a joystick.
Cam, next up on my list, though, maps, stellar cartography. Stay with me for a second here. Every time they're depicted, they're almost entirely in two dimensions. The galaxy is not a flat disk, you know, and it also makes it very confusing. Whenever I see, like, fans do maps of, like, the territories within the galaxy, it's made to look like a map of Earth, you know, in which you've got, like, different territories separated by different colors, and it's all flat.
Mm-hmm.
It just doesn't make sense, though. Like, space is in three dimensions. And I think that it's also much easier to grasp the close proximity of places like Earth and Kronos, Romulus, if it's all kind of overlapping, you know, like, well, one star system could be above the other and then perpendicular to another. So maybe think of it as like candies inside of a cake that's been baked, you know, and like the candies represent star systems, and maybe an M&M is aligned with a Federation, and we have a gumdrop aligned with Kronos, and they don't all have to be, you know, two-dimensionally aligned. They can like hover over each other or underneath each other. I think that actually explains a lot about the mechanics of just space travel and how all these distances seem to be, well, not as distant as we might think.
Yeah, for sure. That's a delicious metaphor you made.
I'm hungry. That's probably why I made that.
But yeah, you know, there's of course that episode Fair Trade where Neelix has to get the map, right?
Yeah.
Does that map even make sense that he has to get? It was on paper, wasn't it? Wasn't it like a scroll?
Oh, I thought it was like a Isolinear chip or something.
Okay,
like that.
I'm misremembering. I think I prefer to remember it as a scroll.
Okay. That'd be amazing. And like whenever he opened it up, somebody had to like toot on a horn. Like the scroll comes down.
But yeah, like I agree with you. The mapping, I think the part of the problem is though, is that obviously I think the show probably knows that mapping would be very, very different, but the way to visually communicate that to an audience is very difficult.
Oh yes. But I think they have the opportunity to do that in Discovery and Picard right now with all of the three-dimensional like view screens and monitors that we see now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, we'll see if they do. Yeah. I've got one. Speaking of Discovery, actually, this is something that kind of, I think a lot of fans would bring up and consistently did through Discovery and you know, some of the other shows. But when we have technological breakthroughs like the Spore Drive or breaking the Warp 10 barrier, things kind of go iffy, and then that technology is never referenced again. And it's like, okay, I can believe that, you know, breaking the Warp 10 barrier, that obviously had some problems. But don't tell me they wouldn't be looking at alternate ways to do this, to shield people, to continue the evolution of this technology, or to apply it in some other way. Same with the Spore Drive.
Oh, no kidding. It makes me think of Buffy the Vampire Slayer whenever Willow would come up with this amazing witch's spell, and they would never use that spell again. And it's right. Like, oh, okay. Well, that's kind of lame.
And I feel like Picard, the series Picard, really opened the door to be able to maybe show the evolution of space travel and things like that, and it hasn't really done any of that. It hasn't. I don't know that it feels very different, really, in terms of space travel, other than people having magical gizmos that do things, you know, in the season finale.
Well, one of the moments that I did like, though, is when we had Drati go to Rios and just comment on the trip. She was just like, I am bored. Like, who knew that all there was in outer space was just more space? And there was just like this moment where they just kind of like stop on the view screen. You just watch them going and going and going. And she's right. Like, until you get to another planet, there's really not that much to do. You could get a little bit of cabin fever.
Oh, for sure. But, you know, let's go to one of our favorite episodes, Threshold. Tom Paris breaks the Warp 10 barrier and bad things happen. Yes, but he was also the first flight. Are you telling me that no one tried to do further flights? You know, and even they sent back test subjects like robots or something or androids? I don't know. It seems like the sort of thing that might be worth exploring.
Well, maybe Janeway never put that in her official log unless she wanted to reveal that she and Tom got it on and produced some salamander babies that they abandoned.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Speaking of Tom Paris, though, can we talk about evolution as it's depicted in Star Trek?
Go for it.
Especially in the episode Thresholds. They describe it, like, you know, turning into some salamander as this accelerated form of evolution, as if there's this predetermined genetic code that everyone eventually gets to. There's no such thing as that. That is not what evolution is at all. Evolution is how our societies or our species react to our environments, and the ones that are better able to adapt our genes spread. We're able to procreate more, and those become the dominant genes.
Mm-hmm.
It's about exposure to different environments, not some sort of pre-programmed genetic traits that we might have. And so what they're talking about there is creative design, not evolution. And evolution is a fact. It is observable. There's no question that it exists. That's why we get flu shots every single year.
Mm-hmm.
That's the very definition of evolution. Those viruses evolve. There's absolutely no evidence of creative design. And that's what's depicted in Threshold. And it just irks me that, like, there's another episode of Discovery. I'm blanking on which one it was, but I remember at the Star Trek convention last year, biologist Mohammed Noor, he cited another example in Discovery where what he was saying is, like, they're not describing evolution. They're describing, like, metamorphosis. I think it was the episode dealing with the Tilly fungus stuff, or maybe the tardigrade. I'm blanking on which one. But, like,
okay.
I just think that Star Trek doesn't quite grasp the difference between evolution and, say, metamorphosis.
And they do have a science advisor, so I wonder how much of is it them not grasping it versus going, yeah, but we want to tell this story.
I bet it's a lot of the writers just, like, saying, like, whatever science advisor, no, we're just going to write evolution. Everyone knows that what that means. But it's just like, does everyone know that what that means? Because you guys sure don't seem to.
And to be fair, Brandon Braga has said, yeah, we know Threshold didn't make any sense.
Well, yeah. But there's like some interesting things that they did sprinkle around there. Like, say, that common ancestor that was depicted in the TNG episode, The Chase. Mm-hmm. That's kind of an interesting possibility about how maybe they sprinkle their genes. But the thing is, like, we all know that we have common ancestors here on Earth. So maybe those humanoid common ancestors spread some real proto genes onto different planets. I gotta know. But then distant origin, in which we have those dinosaurs evolve into bipedal reptiloids that can talk just like us with vocal cords, that really didn't make any sense to me at all from an evolutionary standpoint. It seemed far too coincidental, but it was still a fun episode.
Well, I mean, you could also say, why are so many aliens humanoid?
Well, no, that's what they were trying to explain with Chase.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Okay. There's the answer right there.
But, like, across the galaxy, like, all aliens, like, it seems like every alien they encounter has, like, humanoid features.
Well, so in The Chase, they depict this ancient species, and we're talking, like, a species from billions of years ago. What they did is they went across these early planets, and they deposited their genetic material there, and that's why we ended up with all of these species that appear to be humanoid, just like that common ancestor. So that issue has been explained in Star Trek. So,
but were they in the Delta Quadrant?
They said they went across the galaxy. So
okay, fair enough.
Yeah. So, Cam, what's next up for you?
Okay, the introduction of god-like aliens in Star Trek raises a lot of questions, because obviously you have Q, you have Trelane, you have Nigillum, you have the tentacle monsters from God knows where in Picard. These are real serious problems. And it seems like the Federation lives in, you know, constant concern of war with the Klingons, war with the Romulans. What are they going to do? And why has no, like, god-like alien somehow popped up on Earth and caused immense havoc?
We'll call it creative license, right?
You're telling me, like, Trelane wouldn't just, like, skip over there and just, like, do things just for a laugh?
I know it is kind of frustrating that, like, they can also just be used as a deus ex machina, which is always, for me, it's kind of frustrating if you're looking for good storytelling as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then there's, like, some, like, Apollo, for example, who did live on Earth and was treated like a god, and left when people didn't believe him anymore. But it's like, what's to stop that guy from going back and just being like, hey, look, people, I'm throwing lightning bolts and stuff here.
What? No kidding. So, do you believe me now?
Exactly.
It's just like the godlike stuff. The thing is, with the godlike species that are depicted, they all seem quite petty, don't they?
That's what's more of a concern. If they were all, like, benevolent and just, like, kind, you'd be like, you know what? I totally understand this, their reasoning for not invading Earth or just showing up and trolling Earth. But maybe, a lot of the ones we meet, you know, I don't know about the ones we meet.
Maybe the more benevolent godlike beings are deflecting the petty godlike beings from pursuing that sort of stuff.
I mean, I hope so.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Starfleet security really hopes so.
Cam, next on my list, bathrooms. They've really never spelled it out crystal clear on Star Trek. On Deep Space Nine, there are a couple seasons they're calling it waste extraction, which was pretty funny. The word extraction is very vivid there, but
yeah.
But I believe as Jake Sisko, he made the very first reference in all of Star Trek to the word bathroom.
Oh.
I believe that was on Explorers when they get on that Bajoran ship, and he walks around and he's like, is that supposed to be the bathroom? You know, then Ben kind of shrugs. Like, to me, it's just like, okay, at least they're acknowledging it. I think there may have been a toilet featured on Discovery, if I recall correctly, but I don't think we've ever seen one in like TNG or DS9 or Voyager.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if how often toilets were even shown on TV at that point. In like hour-long dramas, if they would often show bathrooms. But
I guarantee you, Cam, a toilet has been depicted in an hour-long drama.
They would.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm wondering if at least the original series, because they didn't show a toilet on a movie screen until 1960 with Psycho. I wonder if they would have been allowed to in 66, you know, when the show was actually on the air. I don't know about that one.
There's no production code that they had to abide by or anything like that. So.
Yeah,
I don't think there's anything stopping them. What would have been the hang up of featuring a toilet in 1966?
I don't know.
Yeah.
To me, it doesn't make any sense at all, period. But I'm wondering if it'd be more like TV had to be family friendly, especially
in
that era.
This is the era where like husbands and wives would sleep in separate beds.
Yeah, exactly. So,
yeah.
So maybe, but in terms of the Berman era and everything, it doesn't really make sense. You think they'd come up even with like just like a quirky idea for what a bathroom is, you know, kind of like the three seashells in Demolition Man.
That's our go-to reference because sci-fi's depiction of bathrooms, it always leaves us kind of like rubbing our chins to a certain degree.
Yeah, I guess maybe they just didn't have the imagination or weren't willing to put forth the imagination to figure out what a like futuristic urinal is.
Yeah. Cam, I've got one or two more on my list. Do you have one or two more, or do you want to do a lightning round, or what are your thoughts?
Yeah, why don't we just kind of do a lightning round, and we can just kind of bounce back and forth and touch on some of these.
Yeah, take it away, sir.
Okay, what about land? Like, who owns land? Because we know Picard has his chateau. Raffi has her trailer that she complains about a lot. Like, who owns land, and how do they get it?
Yeah, I can't really wrap my head around that. It's inherited, perhaps. That's why Picard still has the chateau.
Yeah, I guess.
Who does that chateau go to after Picard passes? Well, Picard has already passed away. So have his helpers inherited the chateau now?
I have no idea. Or does Wesley get Beverly's family estate with Ronan the Candle?
Good point, yeah. He gets to live there with Ronan the Candle.
I would watch that show.
Yeah.
Perfect Strangers, the reboot.
Yeah, the land stuff makes no sense for me. Next on my list, fashion. Everyone either wears vests or jumpsuits. None of it looks comfortable. None of it looks particularly fashionable as well.
Yeah.
I think the Discovery costume design has been the best so far in the series. I think that's followed closely by the original series and just how vivid it looks and how, maybe I could wear that. I think a close third, though, is Star Trek Picard, where it looks far more contemporary than things were ever depicted in the TNG era. It's stuff I could imagine myself actually wearing in day-to-day life.
Yeah. What do you think the key is? Is it just keeping it somewhat simple?
I think that's it. But isn't a jumpsuit very simple? Like,
yeah.
Look at what Jake wore those first four seasons until they started giving him vests. That was simple, but it looked silly. Same with like Wesley's jumpsuits where, you know, the back of his jumpsuit, it never quite buttoned all the way up at the waist. Like that always like irked me.
Oh, yeah. I think the 60s show had a benefit of, for whatever reason, 60s fashion has aged incredibly well.
Yeah.
And they did sort of a sci-fi 60s look on that show. And for some reason, it's just held up incredibly well. Part of me thinks it's luck. It's kind of like when George Lucas designed Star Wars. Like, why did so many of the fashions hold up reasonably well?
The haircuts did not, with the perms that they all had.
True. There. Yeah. I mean, Star Trek was fairly good with the haircuts on the original series, too, where they kept them fairly short with, like, the pointed sideburns. Next Generation got a little wacky with the hairdos, though, and the Berman era as a whole.
Yeah. You have another item on your list you want to share?
Yeah, mining.
The obsession with mining in the 24th century?
This is something we've joked about often, but we talked earlier about jobs, and why is it not all, like, robots doing all the mining? Like, who is the person that's like, you know what? I want to serve, you know, the Federation. I'm going to go be a miner on some godforsaken planet, like in Mud's Women or something.
I would never condemn myself to do that, especially if I had the opportunity to be like Bashir's father and just, you know, choose any career I want every 6 months.
Yes. That fascinates me still.
Cam, universal translators. They seem to have the ability to mimic the words that people are going to say on top of their mouths. They try to make sense of it in Star Trek Discovery with Into the Forest We Go.
Yeah.
That was interesting. But you were kind of wondering, like, well, explain to me how you can watch a Romulan on the view screen apparently speaking English when you know that the Romulan is not actually speaking English on his side of the view screen, right?
Can you imagine the number of complaints that they would get if the show aired with the human sort of English voice coming over and the mouth wasn't matching on the screen?
I know.
It would be chaos.
I would not want to watch that myself, you know? It's just one of those things that I think it's best if they just kind of leave it vague, like
I thought
other things.
Star Trek Beyond did actually a pretty good job with it. Where there was that alien captain or alien that they met who was part of, who had escaped from Krall's compound or quote unquote escaped. Yeah. And they were using their universal translator there and the mouth didn't match.
That was interesting.
Yeah, it was an interesting take, but you can see why they went with it there because it was very limited. It was only like, you know, a couple minutes of screen time.
Well, my favorite depiction, though, is in Little Green Men where the Ferengi, they crash land on 1940s Earth. And their universal translators malfunction. So you get to see it just from like an artistic kind of depiction. You get to see it from the Ferengi perspective where you have these very affected, echoey human voices that even the viewers can't understand what these Americans are saying in English. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the Americans' perspective and you have the three aliens speaking the Ferengi language. Like that to me was like kind of a fun way of depicting how things would work if the universal translator malfunctions.
Definitely, yeah, yeah. So, no, that was definitely a fun usage. I think Star Trek needs to do more with that and have more fun with it. I thought that Discovery episode where it went on the Fritz was super fun. I think you can do more things with it. I would love to see maybe, like Little Green Men, a more comedic episode of Discovery or something play around with that. I think
they could definitely do something.
Yeah, it could be fun. I am really curious what the future is of like the animal kingdom, because Star Trek has always been kind of vague on that. They probably still want to have to rent lions or something. But, you know, we know that whales were extinct or humpback whales, but we don't know much else. And even down to the small things, you know, there was that story in National Geographic, how there was real issues during the COVID pandemic because rats suddenly didn't have easy access to food and were suddenly running out in broad daylight and fighting each other. And we even at my work suddenly had rats burrowing into all the gardens near my work, which had never happened before. So like, do rats exist in the 24th century? Because we've always been told they're the one thing that will survive, them and cockroaches.
Yeah. Two words for you.
Yeah.
John Hammond. They all just get clones if they go extinct at this point.
I would just love to know how many animals are extinct or if there is like a flourishing animal world in the 24th century. I have no idea.
Their version of Tiger King. last on my list, the Prime Directive. this non-interference with pre-warp civilizations, no exceptions, except it's violated all the time. I get it. It is an interesting concept. But look, let's be realistic. If there's like a giant meteor that's shooting at a planet, I don't think the Federation would hesitate to nudge that meteor out of the way. But if it's like a nuclear missile that one pre-warp civilization is shooting across a continent on their own planet, then the Federation draws the line there. Like, it's just kind of like, I understand the urge in that we don't want like the Klingons, the Romulans, the Federation conquering all of these pre-warp civilizations and exploiting them. But then you get into the whole dilemma. It's just like, so are we just going to let them suffer willingly when we have the ability to stop that?
Right. Well, then it's like the volcano in Star Trek Into Darkness, which Spock stops, and they get in trouble for that. It's like, okay.
Really? Like the admirals want, you know, thousands of innocent people to just perish for what reason?
Well, exactly. And I mean, Kirk, you know, will stop computers that run civilizations like, you know, in the Apple or in, you know, is it Taste of Armageddon? Yeah, I think it's Taste of Armageddon. You know, it's like, obviously, you know, it's a computer that's controlling things. So maybe there's a little bit of leeway there, but still the society is the one that allowed themselves to be run by the computer. So it's like, does the captain have any right to just step in and interfere? I have no idea. It doesn't really make any sense.
No, it's bizarre. I swear there will be a movie or an episode or even a spinoff one of these days just called Star Trek Prime Directive.
Well, that was one of the working titles of Insurrection.
It was, yes, indeed. Yeah.
Should they have kept that?
No. Well, versus Insurrection?
Yeah.
I think it is a stronger title than Insurrection, even though, what does it mean to the average audience goer?
Yeah, what does Insurrection mean to the average audience?
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
They just never won with that one. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Let us know what some of the nagging things are in the 24th century that bother you. Are there any we missed that stick out? Let us know. So Tyler, what are we doing next time?
Cam, we're going to tackle the different eras of Star Trek. Stay tuned. It's going to be different than maybe what we usually do here, but I think there's some very distinct eras of the franchise over the last 50 years, and we're going to delve into what they're trying to accomplish from a storytelling perspective, from character levels as well, and what it really represents for modern Star Trek and what their mission statement is at this point. So I think we'll have a very in-depth, very intriguing conversation about all these different eras of the franchise.
Looking forward to it. Okay, you can, of course, find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam, V as in vests, and more vests in the 24th century, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's Reporton, N as in non-interference with pre-warp civilizations.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.